Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 15, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Tonight was yet another single interview show coming to you on recording. I'm out of town at yet another conference. Time is short, so I'll drop the usual economic headlines tonight. I'm preempted next week, so back in 2 weeks with some fresh economic news. Tonight's interview is with Jagdish Bhagwati. Bhagwati is a professor of economics at Columbia University. He was born in India in 1934 and studied at Cambridge, Oxford, and MIT. He taught for a while in India and then moved back to MIT in 1968. He's been at Columbia since 1980. Regarded as one of the leading trade economists alive, he's been an advisor to GATT and its successor, the World Trade Organization, as well as the United Nations. He writes frequently for the op-ed pages of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times. He's also a director of the National Bureau of Economic Research and a fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations. This interview was recorded at the Council's offices on the east side of Manhattan. All in all, it doesn't get much more orthodox than that. It's not often we hear on this show from people who are so orthodox, so I thought he'd make for an interesting change of pace. But while Bhagwati's resume reads like a pinnacle of the establishment, he's a lot more thoughtful and politically liberal than your average wind-up free trader, and he writes a lot better than almost anyone else in his profession. His latest book is In Defense of Globalization, recently published by the Oxford University Press, which provided the occasion for this interview. Though most of what he says is pretty comprehensible to a non-specialist audience, a couple of pointers before we listen. He speaks of Ferdinand Cardoso, a former Marxist sociologist who became a very orthodox free market president of Brazil, immediately preceding Lula. Cardoso made his academic name by developing dependency theory, which held that the poorer countries enter the world market in a structurally subordinate position. On taking office, however, Cardoso governed in ways very pleasing to Wall Street and the IMF. Bhagwati speaks of the fund, by which he means the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. He also speaks of bilaterals, by which he means free trade agreements between pairs of countries, notably the U.S. and others, as opposed to multilateral agreements, which are signed by all members of the World Trade Organization. Bilaterals allow the U.S. to throw around its weight much more than multilateral arrangements do. While I think it's well worth listening to what Bhagwati has to say, and I agree with a lot of what he has to say about trade being nowhere near as destructive as lots of people on the left often argue, I certainly don't agree with all of it. He's a good economist who believes in capitalism and market prices. Note that he doesn't really fully answer a lot of the questions I ask him. While he remarks on the contrast between economic theory and real-world practice, this doesn't really lead him to reconsider the relevance or validity of the theory itself. He's got no sense of the limits of routine democracy, the way in which many significant questions of economic policy and property relations are simply considered outside politics. To quote Richard Feinberg, a former national security advisor to Bill Clinton, democracy only works when there's fundamental agreement on the nature of property. What kind of democracy is that, really? But enough of me. Here's Jagdish Bhagwati in an interview recorded a couple of weeks ago.
In a lot of circles, globalization is the great evil, and it's identified as the cause of increased inequality, greater economic insecurity, and environmental degradation. You argue against the standard analysis that it's led to an increase in poverty and polarization, so let's review some of that territory.
Yeah, that's the main one, I think, as far as the developing countries are concerned. I mean, they're generally in the 50s and 60s were fearful of integration of the world economy because it was a bit like, you know, it was called the center and periphery problem, and people were behind the curve and who were underdeveloped really were afraid of competition and getting into the world economy. And then was Walter Sunkel, and who was another sociologist in Chile, talked about how integration into the world economy would lead to disintegration of the national economy. So there were these fears, and sociologist Cardoso, who then recently became the president Cardoso of Brazil, he had developed the notion of what he called the dependencia thesis. Again, the same problem, that you'd not become interdependent, but you'd become dependent. So that was a sort of the set of worries. And I think along with that went the notion that you'd be hurting up, you know, screwing up your development. And two, implicitly in that was a notion that you wouldn't be able to grow, you know, have your poor grow out of because, you weren't going to grow the pie and so on, that you were simply going to be in a neo-colonial embrace, which was still another angle, you know, which President Nkrumah of Ghana was writing about, sort of malign intent and not just malign impact on these countries. I think people change their mind. And of course, this is the normal seesaw, I mean, which you do get. And what you asked me about was that, I mean, today, at least as of 5 years ago, I would say, most of the policymakers in the developing countries who had actually been fearful and had turned inwards and, you know, gone away from this embrace with the center had come to the view that it really didn't pay off. And part of the reason, of course, is, you know, not just learning by your undoing, but also learning by other people's doing. And the Far Eastern economies were not fearful of the world economy. And in fact, starting 60s, they sort of turned outwards. And I mean, it doesn't mean they had free trade, but they were basically using the international opportunity in a creative sort of way and grew much faster. Trade and globalization, generally speaking, because all we can talk about is central tendencies, you can always find a body of experience where it was done badly and so on, or where there were special circumstances which really led to a disaster. But by and large, the evidence is that trade has contributed to growth. And the next step of the argument is that growth in turn has pulled people out of poverty, underemployment, unemployment, into sustained gainful employment, and therefore out of poverty on a sustained basis, because short-run solutions you can always have. I think you have to give it a little play, because a lot of people just look at 5 years, 10 years, and I don't think economics can be judged in that short a period. You have to see it over a period of maybe 20 years, 25 years, and that's what's convincing that you know, take debt-led growth. I mean, I was talking about trade, but South America consistently goes on a borrowing binge, as you know. So during the 10 years they borrow money, like in the 70s when the, you know, oil monies were available, and Servan Schreiber used to arrive, you know, as a Frenchman who worried about the American challenge, if you remember, he was a socialist. But then he was into, you know, petrodollars, so he would arrive with bags full of cash. He went to India, and Mrs. Gandhi said, you know, get lost, we don't want to take this risk of borrowing this money. India is probably overly cautious. Then he went to South America, and he found most of them were dictatorial regimes at that time. And one thing dictators love is to you know, be profligate while they're in power. They don't think of the future. They went in for a very remarkable growth rate during the 70s. Then arrives Paul Volcker, and he tries to take inflation out of the world economy. So everything goes down the tubes. So you had reverse flows and crashes in that region. So you had 10 years of what economists call in jargon negative growth, meaning decline in standard English.
Well, people will, for example, people will point to that experience, say, compare growth rates in the 20 years before 1980 with the 20 years after 1980. Wow. And in Latin America, the comparison's quite unfavorable.
Exactly.
There is, at least according to the official numbers, the growth rates in the 60s and 70s were pretty strong, and since they've been flat or negative even in some cases.
Yeah,
so what happened? I mean, a lot of people look at those numbers and say it's all neoliberalism's fault since that started around 1980.
Really, again, it depends. I mean, you know, the phrase Washington consensus is used all the time, and I've never understood. I think it was done in relation to South America. When I talk of, I mean, Washington usually follows the consensus, doesn't create it. I mean, I've never heard any interesting ideas come out of the World Bank, for example, despite the tons of money they spend on research. But they, essentially, when I talk of, you know, what did we kind of learn from the earlier experience, for what it's worth? And I think there were two things we learned was that politically it was good to have a democracy. You didn't really need dictatorships or authoritarian regimes to move ahead. And that's one part of the story. And the other is that, you know, we can the knee-jerk intervention which we had around the world, because I'm now talking about the developing countries, because, you know, when you have scarcities and you're behind the curve, both of those reasons then lead to a rather to the notion that you should really be intervening wherever you have, both for distributive reasons because of scarcities, and two, because you're behind the curve, you've got to, you know, go ahead and have the government pull in things, you know, do things which, you know, not just leave to things to the market. Not entirely bad ideas, actually, but on the other, I mean, it led to an extreme swing of the pendulum in that direction. You know, you could call it knee-jerk interventionism, but it was to be expected, because to do anything else in that situation would have looked counterintuitive, you know, lack of common sense. I think it took us a while to understand, to swing from that extreme to a little bit closer to the center and say, look, maybe we can use markets, and maybe, you know, this excessive obsession with being able to do things through state intervention is a can be a problem. And we felt that we had not allowed markets to work at all, and that we really had to move sort of to defining, sticking to our objectives, but sort of opening up the instruments so as to allow for additional play of what might be called market principles.
I'm speaking with Jagdish Bhagwati, author of In Defense of Globalization, recently published by Oxford University Press. There's a great deal of disagreement over certain empirical issues, and it would come down to has the amount of poverty increased or decreased in the world? Has the gap between rich and poor widened? Well, you present a bunch of studies that argue that poverty is been reduced by globalization, and that you sort of dismiss polarization as a significant concern. There are a lot of other studies, you sort of dismiss those, but it looks to me like the evidence is a lot more ambiguous than you would take it. There's increased poverty in some regions. Latin America has done rather poorly over the last 20 years. East Asia has done very well, but it depends upon where you look. Africa has done miserably. Africa has done miserably. So let's go over the parts of the world.
I think it's very important, because I think the, I mean, it depends on how you view what is in fact, I mean, what is good globalization, because there are weak dimensions to it. I'm not a fan, as I've already, you know, implied, of debt-led growth. I think it immediately puts you into vulnerable situations of capital funds can flow out very fast and so on, as they did in the East Asian financial crisis, and there was a lot of contagion from that as well. So I think that is a dangerous sort of thing to do. As I look at South America, what happened? They first moved away from dictatorship increasingly to democracy. That was a good sign. Two, a lot of them continued into this in this mode, macroeconomic mode of basically borrowing money all the time. Even President Cardoso, I was talking to him the other day, and I said, look, you know, you gave up your dependence, your thesis, and now you was going for globalization. But I said, you left Lula behind with a whole lot of external debt. And why did you do that? I said. So he said, oh, well, we had needs and, we, you know, money was available. But that's exactly the point, is even someone like him, you know, who was a sociologist, had written about dependencia, did not think the matter through. And he thought, really, this was something you could do without any consequences. That has been true of the bulk of the regimes. The only one which really has been careful, particularly careful, is Chile for the last 20 years or so. And this is no, I mean, I'm not complimenting Pinochet by any means. I mean, he was earlier. But that economic management, you know, which is by many groups of people, was much more sensible, because they had an early payments crisis related to heavy external borrowing about 20 years ago. They decided then to have what is known as a Tobin tax, but applied at a national level, meaning a tax on capital flows. But they taxed when they thought that the amount of external borrowing that the system was doing was getting rather uncomfortable in relation to their ability to service it and so on. They immediately started using a tax on it to try and reduce it, so that in their own judgment, the the vulnerability to panic-fueled outflows, which can be quite enormous, as you know, because it's not just the funds that come in which will go out. Your own people will take their own funds out. And, you know, there's a quibble about it in Mexico 94. Did the Mexicans take it out first or the you know, our firms down the street in Wall Street? It doesn't matter who starts it. But the point is they all do it in the end if you have capital account convertibility. So they actually were very careful, and they immediately instituted this thing, which is not capital controls, but it's a price version of capital controls. I mean, you don't want capital controls all the time necessarily, but you want to be able to slap them on, you know, when something goes wrong. So I think they reduced their trade barriers down to an average of about 5% on a, you know, they went not too fast, but they went consistently down and brought them down to OECD levels, meaning, you know, Western nations levels. And on foreign investment coming in, meaning the multinationals, they've been a little bit more relaxed than, you know, I mean, nobody eliminates it completely that I know of, I mean, among the developing countries, but it's been more relaxed. So I think that is the sort of, if you ask me, you know, and they've got rid of Pinochet and they're into a democracy and now they're even a socialist government. So they have essentially done what I think should be the consensus, which is that trade, multinationals, don't get too excited. It's going to be basically productive to you. Two, don't get into debt-led growth. I mean, that's a two-edged sword. It can be very good while it lasts, but it can really plunge you down. And have democracy, because that's, I mean, you know, if something begins to go wrong, there's nothing like a democratic system to go to the streets and take those guys out. I mean, you know, if you think there's something wrong being done. So they've had the exact right combination of what I would say should be our consensus. Instead, what they've done, I mean, they say, oh, the fund recommended this, the fund recommended that. I don't know what the fund recommended to those guys, but the point is all I see is what they did. And a lot of things they've done were self-engineered also, like when Cavallo in Argentina insisted on having a currency board, which is close to the gold standard, meaning a fixed exchange rate, essentially. He was told repeatedly by people, including some of the fund people, you know, this is really risky and don't do it. And so, but he insisted on keeping it there. You know, the main problem is that when you have something like a currency board, you know, where you simply say, look, it is going to impose discipline, so I'm not going to get inflation at home, and I'm going to, that's the old gold standard argument. I have fixed the gold, you know, the price of my currency. That itself will lead to discipline, and therefore people will not lead to more, you know, excess expenditures and so on. Well, I mean, that's kind of begging the issue. It's a fair weather crisis. You know, just a little rain, not a tornado, then it does work, I mean, to create some discipline. But the reason why the gold standard broke down was because the discipline disappeared. And then so does the gold standard breaks down because, you know, you get into massive difficulties in the balance of payments and so on. So and the way I was saying it, you know, the people then took to the streets because, you remember all the pictures of the workers and so on. Because the system was completely broke. So my witticism at the time was that the currency board is made by man, but it is broken by men, in plural, who take to the streets. Because to maintain that, you have to create so much unemployment that people are going to take to the streets. They're not going to simply give up. I don't think the fund could, IMF could be blamed for it. So Cavallo committed suicide all on his own. Nobody pushed him particularly anyway.
But Wall Street liked him.
Oh, yeah, that is true. Wall Street loved him. I mean, Wall Street, I think, was putting pressure for, I mean, their business is lending, right? So naturally, they would love a system where people are going to borrow like mad. And that's where, again, it's not the Republicans or Democrats, because it was the Democratic administration of President Clinton, not he himself, but, you know, Bob Rubin, Larry Summers, all these people were into this game of simply not understanding the downside of capital flows and simply I think Rubin, it's not that he's weird or wicked, but his entire life experience was on Wall Street in Goldman Sachs. And Larry Summers was caught up in this reaction to excessive intervention as to that swing of the pendulum and probably suspended his judgment because he's a brilliant economist, there's no question about it. And they all went along with it. So, and they, you know, I think this is something where I think it cut across parties at that point, you know, and it really had to do with the whole sort of lobbying plus ideological shift away from excessive intervention to kind of suspending your guard about even areas where you should be more prudent and not really leave it, you know, because if you let markets rip, I mean, they will rip you off, I mean, you know, essentially. And so you really have to be careful. Now, you take Africa, you asked me about that. That's a very different, and there I would simply, you know, this has so much internal strife. And I think that has also led to the bad governance. It's not the bad governance that has led to. I mean, you know, the Africans are as smart as the rest of us. And they can really certainly do a number of things. But they've gotten caught up in, all, like the Middle East in some ways. I mean, it's all these colonial powers drawing arbitrary lines and so on. And then that interacting with, you know, the rise of ethnicity and tribal, you know, ethnicity and so on. It's sort of gotten out of hand, and it's, I think it's led to terrible governance in that situation. The only thing you want to ask, Doug, is, and here I'm not talking like an economist, just as a general intellectual, say, look, in that situation, do you want, I mean, wait, bad governance, strife are all there, and nobody is going to be able to fix it any more than the Bush administration or anybody can fix Iraq in a hurry. I mean, we will never be able to fix it. That's our nightmare. But given that, do you want an open, relatively open economy, because you're never going to get free trade and so on, but, you know, freer trade? Do you want a little more investment coming in? My sense is, and, you know, you can easily dispute it if you want to, but not that easily, but like-for-like comparison, I would say more openness is more likely to bring the sunshine, you know, what I call the Dracula effect. You expose evil to sunlight. Hopefully it'll shrivel up and die. Though in Dracula films, Dracula always rises again.
I'm speaking with Jagdish Bhagwati, a professor of economics at Columbia and author of In Defense of Globalization. Well, let's go back to the Mexican example, because right. We're just a little over 10 years of NAFTA now. Right. And the Mexican experience has, in many ways, not been very inspiring. It's done everything it's supposed to. There's not been a whole lot of development, still high levels of unemployment, a lot of displacement of peasants, low growth rates, and the real value of the minimum wage is down 10 or 20% since NAFTA took effect. Yet, in many ways, Mexico has held up as the model country for years. It was supposedly doing everything right, at least before the crisis came. What happened, and you know, why should anyone adopt the trade agreements with the United States or adopt Washington's advice when our star pupil has been doing not so well?
I mean, I actually, if you go to South America, everybody wants to embrace it. Like, it's amazing how many countries are queued up outside Zolik's door. So I'm just saying that. That's not the way it's perceived. They think Mexico has done very well, but you're raising a very serious question.
Well, like, it did create lots of really billionaires, done? So the business class can do very well.
Makers seem to be wanting it, but I mean, I'm not in favor of these bilateral agreements because I think they're a pox on the trading system, and they have a whole lot of downsides to them. Like particularly when they try and do it with a hegemonic, you know, big power like us or a hyperpower like us. I mean, the tendency is very much for our lobbies, as Bill Greider wrote, quoting me in The Nation, if you remember. The tendency is for all our lobbies to shove in that one-on-one where we are the big guys, dangling a, you know, big market preferentially to these people for excess. Then we ask all sorts of things in exchange, which they simply give us, where we're playing a really a different game, namely of knocking down the of creating more and more divisions among the developing countries, like on intellectual property protection. I mean, I believe there should be some, but there was the kinds of intellectual property protection we built into the World Trade Organization is far too excessive. I mean, only because AIDS broke out in Africa, that that our pharmaceutical companies retreated on, because their notion was in the WTO we were going to reopen the issue only to make things worse for the meeting, tighten the screws on intellectual property.
So, the U.S. developed part by stealing other people's patents.
Oh, absolutely. You're so right, and they like to forget that. I mean, because at that time we were consumers of intellectual property. Now we are producers of it. So it's amazing how it changes your perspective. Your whole economic theory and philosophical perspectives change. But that we used muscle power, you know, under what was called Special 301 legislation, which was part of the 1988 Act on the Omnibus Trade and Competitiveness Act, which I often call the ominous trade and competitiveness, trying to flex our muscles as we often do. But that was just for the punishment part. We threatened countries like Taiwan under the Special 301, saying we're going to raise our tariffs, you know, if you don't conform to what we think you ought to have, what we think is unreasonable practice on your part. So only a big country can lay down the law like that. At the same time, aside from the punishments we were doling out, we were also trying to use inducements. Like we got Salinas to agree to very stiff intellectual property requirements, you see, as a price of getting NAFTA. So it was very much like the way we put together the coalition of the willing. This is all coalition of the unwilling, actually, in exactly the same way, because none of Taiwan didn't want to sign on, which was being, you know, hit on the head. Salinas was simply told by all the lobbyists he had hired here, you know, I won't even mention it because I may be subject to libel as to who they were, but I'm sure most people know who they are. They're all taken from congressional staff of key legislative aides and so on to people who mattered and who knew the process, right? So they actually, I think Salinas spent $50 million according to one estimate. And he didn't, I mean, the state of the democracy was such that it wasn't accounted for. He probably got it from corporations. I don't know where he got it from. But it isn't apparently in the books. But these are estimates I've seen from people who study this. So he was told by these people, it's never going to get through Congress NAFTA. And he expended so much goodwill in getting Mexico. I mean, if it didn't go through, life would have been worse. As it turned out, it got worse anyway for Salinas in the end. Anyway, so he, you know, had to sign on to it. He was told, you have to do it. Now, so the way the developing countries at the world, at the multilateral system in GATT at the time were totally opposed to doing anything. But we started almost Leninist style, you know, dividing and conquering, you see. So we were breaking up these coalitions. And ever since then, we've been trying to do this. So I think these bilaterals, as I said, I'm not in favor. In fact, they show very clearly the way, you know, intellectual property people have played this role, and then financial lobbies, you know, because they've been in the two latest agreements with Chile and Singapore. Chile has always used this taxes, I told you, so it has never bought into having free capital flows. And Singapore, too, escaped lightly, actually, but didn't want the option of being able to use capital controls when a crisis strikes or according to his own judgment. Didn't want to have its hands tied. In the end, both countries had to compromise, and I testified before Barney Frank's committee on this. And, you know, Barney Frank, of course, was entirely against it. But all the Republicans and some of the Democrats were very much in favor of shoving this into it. So every lobby uses these bilaterals to use our huge market to shove in some preferences. Shove in something or the other, which that individual little country doesn't pay much attention to, because it's not paying, it doesn't care, it's too small to worry about what happens to the system as a whole. But we played very cleverly. And if you notice, when FTAA would not be signed, you know, by Brazil, Brazil's view was essentially something I agree with, which is that let's get on with liberalizing trade. They were saying, yes, lower your subsidies on agriculture, you know, pay attention to anti-dumping, which we tend to abuse much, almost as badly as the Europeans. Those are trade, direct trade issues, and there's a lot to be done there. And I think Lula and his advisor was entirely right on doing it. Instead, we wanted to shove in all these other things.
And that's the voice of Jagdish Bhagwati, professor of economics at Columbia and author of the book In Defense of Globalization, recently published by Oxford University Press. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM on your radio dial and WBAI.org on the web. And since time is short, no musical breaks tonight, let's go right back to the second part of the interview with Jagdish Bhagwati. From the point of view of a lot of American workers, you know, their jobs went first to Mexico, and then now they're off to China, or in the case of the service sector, India. So there is this wide perception among a lot of American people that jobs are being exported. And even if they're not literally exported, the threat of that movement has resulted in wage cuts and concessions and all kinds of economic unpleasantness. How do you react to that?
I said, you know, the worry about more poor being produced as a result of trade in the poor countries, you know, I don't think it's valid, and you know, I have extensive discussion of it, and I think it doesn't have all the stuff I said about, you know, what went wrong in South America, and then, you know, why we want to think about the Africa very differently and not, you know, put all these experiences into one basket. As far as now, you're raising this other question, which also one has to deal with, which is: are we creating paupers in the rich countries? Are we increasing poverty here? I mean, are the wages of our unskilled workers, in particular, going to go downhill? So, in a way, that worry is as I said, the ironic reversal, because in the earlier game, it's this periphery that was worried about competing with the center. Now the center is worried about what going with the periphery means. And that comes in really not on competitiveness grounds, except in the following sense. It is felt that if you go with trade with the poor countries who have abundance and unskilled labor, poor labor, that was somehow going to hurt our wages. And two, even more important, I think, from certain, at least in my view, is that the hard-won sort of gains in labor standards. I mean, you know, people have actually, confronted the police and corporations and employers and fought and shed blood. I mean, it's not just blood, sweat, and tears and in a metaphorical sense. I mean, so anybody who knows the history of the trade union movement would be worried about, look, I mean, so are we going to get in this globalized economy? You know, people, employers coming and saying, if you don't reduce your, let's reduce your standards, we're just going to go off to Malaysia or somewhere, you know, or Singapore and so on, or Guatemala. So that is a legitimate worry, in my opinion. So that's what's driving it. Because otherwise it looks a bit odd. I mean, here we are the biggest country in the world, the most powerful. So we are like a Rottweiler on the block, you know, a fierce dog. And then we are worried about all these little French poodles, you know, coming from the other side. It sounds a bit odd, you know, but it's a distributional issue, you see, which we are worried. I think competition in general doesn't, but I think the fear that our labor-intensive industries, where we have a whole lot of unskilled labor, like the garment district downtown, what's going to happen to them? You know, I mean, if they disappear down the tubes, I mean, their wages will be suppressed, and their standards reduced. I think on that dimension, I mean, let's leave India out because that is a sort of different case, because that's more computer programmers and stuff like that which they're worried about. Nobody took Indian competition seriously for the labor-intensive goods, simply because India was not relatively autarkic for some time. So India is not in the consciousness the way China is on the labor-intensive goods, because China was ahead of the game and coming very rapidly. So part of the problem with China is the same as the one we had with Japan earlier, except that Japan was a Rottweiler versus Rottweiler competition. That was a different thing. But one of the things which we, our workers in the import competing industries have worried about is that even if these are, you know, I mean, these countries are simply competing fairly, whatever that means, they're growing so fast. Japan was growing so fast, and now China is growing so fast that it's creating waves in the international economy. So You may say, look, China exports, and it also imports, right? So let's not worry about it's building up huge surpluses and creating deflationary impulse in the world economy. And I think that's arguable, that it's not doing it on overall deficit, or overall surplus in her case. You can say, therefore, we shouldn't worry about it, right? But the point is, it's like a giant in a Lilliputian economy, you see. If it's growing so fast and it's so open in terms of its trade to GNP ratio, that it creates waves. So in the export industries, whatever they are, and they tend to vary quite a bit, it's like a huge wave. Now, if you're a surfboard rider, that's terrific to have a huge wave. But for chaps like you and me, we are scared out of our wits. It creates enormous adjustment problems, you see. So I think that's what you're seeing from China's side. And I think this is why you see our unions being sort of terribly worried about. So it's the disruption part. Then there is also the notion that simply competing with people with unskilled labor in abundance is really the reason why our wages of the unskilled workers have been more or less stagnant, I would say, probably for 25 years. I mean, we've had improved periods where there's been blips in improvement and so on. And there's a little debate about, which set of data you use. But even if you take the more optimistic data, it's nothing to write home about what's happened to the wages of our really unskilled, say it's bottom 30% or something. So the question is, what is it that's doing it? Is it really trade with these countries? And what I argue in the book is that but this notion that, all these countries, including China and the Far Eastern economies and Mexico and so on, are coming at us with labor-intensive goods, like, each one adding to the other guy's exports and so on, and they're coming at us like, gangbusters, tsunami. Overwhelming, or like a tsunami, that it doesn't work out that way if you look at the facts, because like Japan was a big one, which first turned to what were called light exports, labor-intensive exports of one kind or another. That was in the in the 60s and then the very early 70s. So they were the major exports of labor-intensive. Then as they got richer and richer, they withdrew from labor-intensive exports and started importing them. And the Far Eastern Four, Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, they were the ones who, if you look at the statistics, who took over from them. So the net effect was, for us, was not all that much, because the big giant Japan withdrew from labor-intensive exports, became an importer, and these other guys simply replaced it.
And the Japanese moved on to wreck the American car industry.
Yeah, I know. But that's when it says, I said, Rottweiler facing a Rottweiler kind of issue. And, it wasn't, yeah. Then we had these Far Eastern Four also declined through the 80s, and it's China that's taking over that market. And, if you ask people who are having babies and buying toys and things like that, and the Toys R Us, you will see actually, I don't know whether there was Toys R Us during the 70s or not, but if there had been one, they'd have been carrying Japanese toys. Then you would have been having South Korean and Taiwanese toys. And then you would be having Chinese toys. And pretty soon it'll be, hopefully, Indian and African as they pick up their marbles, and hopefully they will be able to, or maybe countries in South America also. They've been more into agricultural exports, countries like Chile and Mexico, more than manufacturers. But anyways, that's what you have. So that's the sort of first point I make. And there are lots of studies which show, like manufacturing employment, which we were worried about. That's where the main thrust was. And Vice President Mondale thought we would become a nation of hamburger flippers. We'd go from higher value jobs to lower value jobs, which is a thing which worries, the whole competition with Indian semiconductors and so on, and call centers, etc. But that is where we... The fear was that we would, in fact, lose manufacturing jobs due to international competition. The fact is that in all countries around the world, and this was, in fact, Paul Krugman, who was one of the five or six people who mentioned, you know, looked into that and said that it's this really technological change that seems to be driving the reduction of employment in manufacturers and out of it and whatever it is, and it is not really international trade. Then people like Alan Krueger, who is a labor economist at Princeton, so lots of labor economists also looked at it. And the general conclusion, for what it's worth, was, and it's worth quite a bit if you buy it, was that it was technological change that was driving it and not really international trade. And many people said was maybe if the stagnation or the decline, depending on which data you take, that about 80 to 90% of it was due to technological change and only a little bit due to trade with poor countries. So that's not where the action was. So protection would really not do anything really for you. It was technical change. Although our unions have declined steadily for 30 years or so, very little to do with globalization. It's got to do with Taft-Hartley and, you know, all these, the ease with which we can hire replacement workers, the difficulty of having sympathetic strikes and so on, and actual union busting also in some cases. The fear that many people had that the welfare state would collapse with globalization and so on, it simply hasn't come about in most countries for one simple reason, that we have institutions which are fairly strong, very strong in the political side. And therefore, just because Bill Gates or somebody might say that we'll go out and, you know, to somewhere else if you don't reduce your standards, it just doesn't seem to work out.
I'm speaking with Jagdish Bhagwati, a professor of economics at Columbia and author of In Defense of Globalization. Well, even in orthodox trade theory, there's a concession that there are winners and losers.
Oh, yes.
And that the losers should be compensated. And if the trade theory is correct, it increases growth. There's more income even available to compensate the losers. We don't do much of that in this country. A lot of free trade economists will talk about the benefits of liberalization, but they always forget that part about compensating the losers. And even in your case, I don't recall you writing any op-eds complaining about the lack of compensation for workers who are displaced by trade or even technological change. So what about that side of things?
The reason why I don't write op-eds is because we already, ever since President Kennedy's time, when he went in for the Kennedy round of multilateral trade negotiations in 1962, he had struck a deal with George Meany, the head of the AFL-CIO, saying he would have an adjustment assistance program. That's when it started. The talk about it among economists sort of goes back several more decades, but nobody ever had it. Now, since then, the Republicans from time to time have tried to weaken it on the ground that it doesn't work too well, but two, they're purists, you see, and they say, look, we should have generalized assistance because, you know, you could get screwed by technological change internally. You know, so anybody who gets displaced should have it. But that's our generalized social safety net. But the way I see the world is that it's not xenophobia, but if I get hurt in my steel industry in Pennsylvania because somebody in Ohio is doing something, right, I don't take that as something where I go to my government, you know, for special relief. I mean, it's just part of your own society. But if it's happening because of competition from Seoul or from Tokyo and so on, immediately you feel you need something, you know, it's sort of not kosher. That's the way the real world is, and every community in the world feels that. That's part of the communitarianism to some extent, because we are not just automatons sort of in a borderless world with no attachments and so on. My view, which is a practical one, is that given that fact, we need special adjustments and programs, even, you know, something to supplement the rest. And since President Kennedy's time, we've had that.
I'm speaking with Jagdish Bhagwati, a professor of economics at Columbia and author of In Defense of Globalization. And in conclusion, I think people would look at you and say, you know, here you are. We're doing this interview at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're a tenured professor at Columbia. You're at the top of the heap.
Yeah.
One of the, you know, sure. At the very top of the global income distribution. Yeah. It's easy for you to celebrate the gains from trade and opening, but you really don't suffer any risks from it. You're tenured, too, so that's a very unusual labor market arrangement. How would you react to this critique that you're speaking for a position of great privilege and security, and the people who are actually on the ground are having a much harder time of it?
No, but this is, I mean, it's two things. One, I'm one of the few people who has written an article against the tenure system in the Chronicle for Higher Education. Those things aside, I don't think, I mean, essentially, it is not the trade doesn't necessarily help just the privileged few, because that gets into the income distribution. First, I do believe that it does help poverty in the poor countries. It is creating the pulling people out of poverty, helping create a middle class, which I think is also good for strengthening democracy, because I buy some of the Martin Lipset kind of hypothesis on this. Our side of the street, as I said, it's not, I mean, trade is not the issue in terms of the poverty that we have. So this is where I come to the second side of it, you know, since you're pushing me on it quite rightly. I think, you see, our system depends, I mean, for growth and prosperity, almost uniquely in the world, on very low savings rate, which is a subtraction from the growth effort, because we don't invest as much as a result. But it relies on technological change as the main driver. I mean, there are lots of studies which show that. Of course, it gets embodied in new machines and so on. So you need some investment, but it's the technology that's the main driver of the productivity change, which is being talked about. And it has always been Bob Solow's work. My Nobel laureate teacher at Columbia was at Russell Sage this year in New York. And that showed that technology was the main driver, and lots of people admit that and recognize that. So we are a dynamic, innovative society. But except for the Green Revolution, where it increased the demand for unskilled labor because it led to multiple cropping, Doug, as a result, the demand for labor, for the agricultural laborers, landless labor, went up. So their real wages improved in India, where the Green Revolution took root in a big way. That's about an exception. Virtually every other kind of technological change is like a dagger drawn at the jugular of the unskilled and of the poor people. That is, in my opinion, the main force that's keeping the unskilled down. I think these are the people whom David Shipler writes about, Barbara Ehrenreich writes about, who are going to be earning $15,000, $20,000, no more. Because the skilled are going to get other skilled jobs. That is not our problem. And that would include very highly skilled people like me, medium skilled people, and so on and so forth. How do we help these guys is really the second issue, aside from helping the skilled through their transition, you know, retraining and all the usual stuff, getting medical benefits, dealing from employment. I mean, there's nothing very smart one can say about all that, because we've ad nauseum discussed all that. But I think I don't see, protection is not going to help these guys. Protection is not the source of their problem or lack of it. And my view is essentially that, you know, now that you, at the levels like Berkeley, city council, and so on, you can say, I'm going to ignore my budget constraint and, you know, give them supplements so that they get a living wage, meaning they come up from 15 to maybe 25 or something. Not even that, probably. But it's not going to. It's something which is dead at the federal level, Doug. I mean, even President Clinton sort of signed on to sort of welfare reform, which means essentially that the old way of handing out monies to supplement wages is not really going to be easy. I think we've got to go down the route of people like Thera Scotchpole, etc., who have written about how to design social supplements and so on. I would say, again, this is outside of my area of expertise, but it seems to me that I think we Americans would be the first people to pay for things which are not seen to be doles because they're associated with welfare queens, all that rubbish, you see. But it's sort of, I think if we said, look, I mean, here are very poor mothers and maybe even husband and wife being involved, or partners and so on. But those children should be able to, that culture of poverty we should be able to break by making sure that the children at least get primary education and so on, at least that much, so they get to schooling and so on. We've got to, and I'm told Carrie's working on a medical scheme or medical benefit scheme. But essentially, those are the, I mean, at that level, we have to have some basic health care. What I would like to see, I mean, you know, precisely because I belong to the better off class, I really think all this fuss we are making about outsourcing is really kind of, you know, we need to, as I said, extend the safety net. But these are not that's not our problem. I mean, as far as social policy is concerned, and I think we have to sort of get on with it, I think. And the whole focus on free trade and protection and so on is kind of irrelevant to all this.
It's sometimes been said that we should make a distinction between trade protection and social protection. And
yeah. But that's,
is that what you're trying to get at?
That's right. And social protection we do need. And I think the even to, I mean, our criterion for improvement, for saying free trade is better than protection, or for ranking one policy as better than another one, is just, I mean, the way we economists usually say is because we don't like to say, look, Doug, you have a weight of two and Baguati has a weight of one. I mean, you know, czars can make that kind of choice. The King of Jordan might be able to do it, but not very too many people, thank God. So we say, look, there's going to be distributional impacts usually with many policies because it's very rare for a phenomenon of policy to be such that everybody advances like a Roman legion, all lock and step. It's going to be more chaotic, like in Braveheart. And some people will be going in reverse also when they see the other army approaching. You have to allow for these diverse outcomes. Now, do we then... So how do we say that, you know, supposing in Harlem people have gotten worse off, and on Park Avenue, Rubin and Soros have become better off. And then, so we say, look, in that case, Soros and Rubin it should be possible to take money away from them, from their improvement, and compensate the guys in Harlem, and we would still have some gravy left over. So in that sense, it's a better policy. Everybody can be restored to the original state, and we still have some gravy, and some czar or somebody will decide whether that gravy should go to Harlem or to Park Avenue. If we just say that Harlem has become worse off, Soros and Rubin can compensate them, and, you know, therefore the system is, you know, the policy change is better. And then we say, yeah, therefore the policy should be instituted. And then we don't get these guys in Park Avenue to actually compensate. That's hell, right? I mean, nobody would buy it if you really said that. That's what we economists actually, how we judge policies. I think I would want a very good safety net, and also for things like large dams, actual redistribution or support for the people being displaced, etc., built into it. Our social safety net from the government is not really very considerable by European and other standards. So if you fall through that or don't get, if you haven't found anything or you're still stocking shelves and so on, then you fall on the family. But our family is largely, except in a few communities probably, is the extended family is sort of not there anymore. And the nuclear family, I go to the church weddings and the priest or the minister says, you know, you've got to be married for better or worse. But when worse arrives, I mean, many of the nuclear families are, I mean, the tension is so great, when you're unemployed and so on. There are lots of studies like Catherine Newman and so on the sociological side. When the worst arrives, the family tends to disintegrate rather than bond. I mean, it will bond for a while. And then lots of them disintegrate. That's one of the sociological, you know, phenomena. I think we've got to strengthen the social part. And I think really think very seriously about it. And this is what I would like the Democratic Party to be doing seriously.
That was Jagdish Bhagwati, professor of economics at Columbia and author of the book In Defense of Globalization, recently published by Oxford University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back in 2 weeks. And let's go out with this bit from Future Sounds of India, Shanghai. Seemed an appropriate bit of high-tech globalized India. Till 2 weeks. Bye.